there's a huge amount of scholarship now on just transitions, and a lot of it I find really useful. Another interesting dimension, I think, is some of the subaltern or often excluded voices, particularly from Indigenous groups. So Julia Whittaker's book on Indigenous activism and resistance to the fossil fuel economy, I think that type of work is very useful and a timely reminder that Indigenous groups have been environmental defenders in different ways for centuries, really. And for them, questions of justice, and again, not just justice in the ways we were talking about it earlier around procedural or distributional elements, but also justice to nature.
Hello and welcome to Earthcast, a platform for discussions about bridging the resource gap between people and planet. I am your host, Olivia Taylor, or Olivia Earth on the socials. I have the privilege of interviewing a series of changemakers, thinkers, and disruptors, and asking them about their fields of interest. Together, we will discover fresh perspectives and the most useful levers in society for change. More specifically, we will look at how to solve wicked problems and make decisions at the margin. If you would like to hear more from Earthcast, subscribe and follow us on social media. Earthcast Season 1 explores the just energy transition and unpacks varied topics such as finance, policy, deepening inclusivity, innovative technology, and how to accelerate the transition given climate limitations. Today, we will be speaking to Peter Newell, who is a professor of international relations at the University of Sussex and co-founder and research director of the Rapid Transition Alliance. His recent research focuses on the political economy of low-carbon energy transitions, but he has undertaken research, advocacy, and consultancy work on different aspects of climate change for over 25 years. Peter has worked at the universities of Sussex, Oxford, Warwick, and East Anglia in the UK, and FLACSO Argentina. He sits on the board of directors of Greenpeace UK, and has undertaken advisory work for the governments of the UK, Sweden, and Finland, and for international organizations such as the United Nations Development Programme, the Global Environment Facility, and the Intra-American Development Bank. His single and co-authored books include Climate for Change, Governing Climate Change, Globalization and the Environment, Climate Capitalism, Transnational Climate Change Governance, Global Green Politics and Power Shift, the Global Political Economy of Energy Transitions. Peter, thanks again. I really appreciate your time. And let's get into the first question. So, would you mind giving a short summary of your book, Power Shift, or even perhaps read an abstract or one that sums up the main argument?
Sure. And well, firstly, thanks for having me on the show. Delighted to be able to discuss this book with you. So I'll just read a very short passage. This comes from the introduction to the book Power Shift, The Global Political Economy of Energy Transitions. And it goes like this. Premise of this book is that much of the policy debate so far, as well as existing academic scholarship reviewed earlier, has failed to provide a fuller political analysis of historical precedents of when organized, large-scale, socio-technical and economic change has occurred in the past, and what lessons might be deduced for the current challenge of drastically and rapidly decarbonizing the global economy. It's precisely such a political and historical analysis of transition that is proposed here. This requires the novel fusion of insights from technology and innovation studies, history, economics, and international political economy and ecology about how rapid shifts in systems of production and consumption can occur and be accelerated by political action. This is vital to appreciating the political enabling conditions for the much-fated new industrial or energy revolution now required to tackle climate change and enhance energy security. Rather than focus just on technology or finance in isolation, however, this project addresses the neglected political, historical, and ecological dimensions of energy transitions. It seeks to revisit examples of previous transitions, primarily told through the lens of socio-technical configurations, without sufficient attention to power and politics, and in so doing, provide a more politically inflected account.
I've heard you talking a little bit about the term new normal, especially with regards to discussions about living through a pandemic and the vulnerabilities it has exposed and many pivotal and interconnected systems. Are there any probable opportunities for a just transition to a more sustainable world?
Yeah, I think one thing that the COVID pandemic, however horrific it's been in so many different ways, It has showed us the possibility of rapid change, changing behaviours, changing work patterns, changing patterns of consumption. So, for example, we were told, and we've been told many times, there's not enough money available to accelerate energy transitions and to tackle climate change. And yet suddenly during the COVID pandemic, some governments at least have had access to huge sums of money, which they've mobilized to furlough people and support their livelihoods and jobs when they weren't able to go to the workplace. We're often also told in transition debates that the state can only do so much. That in a neoliberal economy, states can't really intervene. They can't tell industries what to do. They can't force the pace of change. And yet that's precisely what we saw in many cases. You saw governments, for example, in my home country in the UK, asking breweries to start producing hand sanitizer with the alcohol that they would have otherwise used for beer. You had producers of vacuum cleaners being asked to produce ventilators for patients with COVID, et cetera. And so you saw this active, strategic industrial conversion process going on that was mobilized within a very short period of time. And so for me, it showed us that actually when we really want to, when the political will is really there, things can change quite drastically and over quite a short period of time. And that's true in terms of mobilizing finance, which is necessary, in terms of the role of the state and shifting business practices. And of course, also we saw shifting patterns of work, people working at home more, traveling differently, all of these sorts of things, which at least indicate the possibility that behavioral shifts can come about again in relation to the challenge of climate change. So those things for me just give us a little glimmer of light, perhaps hope, that we are capable as a society of responding to some of these challenges.
I think it's probably a good time to mention now that the course that I'm studying at university, your book, Power Shift, is one of my prescribed readings. So
that's good to hear.
Perhaps as a selfish question, could you please, at a high level, for me and my class, what are the enabling and necessary conditions for a just energy transition?
Yeah, it's a very good question. And of course, you can take it on quite an abstract level and talk about the different aspects of justice, whereby you would need procedural justice to make sure that people who are affected by the transition are fully involved. This notion of not leaving people behind that comes from the Sustainable Development Goals. So there's something about who participates and in which spaces to try and define the end goals of the transition and the pace of the transition. So there's that procedural aspect, but there's also a distributional aspect. And of course, the two are related. And the distributional aspect is really who's going to win and who's going to lose from the transition process, and how can losers be protected and compensated where necessary, and how can you mobilize the potential winners? Because one of the key issues we face at the moment is that the losers of a transition towards a lower carbon economy are more powerful and more vocal than the potential beneficiaries. So you hear, you know, oil companies or coal companies or car companies or others constantly protesting about, you know, rising costs or about the impacts that climate or environmental measures have on their profit lines. But you don't necessarily hear so much about the many, many winners that will also come from shifting away from a fossil fuel-based economy. So there's a big distribution element. Another element, of course, is recognition. Who is even seen as the key relevant actors to participate in these debates? And often some of the key actors, like Indigenous peoples, for example, or poorer groups, are often excluded or overlooked in the process. So that, you know, the recognition element in some ways ties back into the procedure element I was talking about before. But then if that wasn't complicated enough, you've then also got the intergenerational element, which is how we allocate costs and benefits over time. And of course, the temptation to pass those costs or go for pathways which might leave future generations to inherit big costs, either economic ones or environmental ones, like inheriting nuclear waste or whatever it might be, or the legacies of particular technological pathways. So there's important intergenerational issues. And that's a huge challenge for institutions. How do you bring the future into the present and make it part of the discussion we're having today? So in sum, you know, just transitions are really about how can you make sure that this necessary process of ecological transition, because of course it's not just about climate change, is as socially just as possible across each of those dimensions that I've mentioned.
So further on that, how has the oil economy been affected by the rising positive sentiment and increasing investment into renewable energy?
Yeah, I mean, the global oil economy is affected by many different things. Partly it is competition from renewable energy and the falling price of solar and wind in particular. But it's also affected by production quotas and the role of OPEC, the oil exporting countries, and the restrictions and the bargaining leverage they have about how much oil they release into the global economy. And so at a time like the present, when there's a crisis in Ukraine and Russia, you find governments like my own in the UK going to Saudi Arabia and asking them to produce more oil and export more oil to other countries. So the oil economy is, on one level, it's really robust because it's lasted a very long time and there's some very, very powerful actors organized around it. But it's also very vulnerable to these shocks in price and supply and disruption of one sort or another. So there's lots of things affecting the oil economy. And of course, questions are increasingly asked about the huge level of fossil fuel subsidies. And of course, that covers oil and gas as well as oil. But, you know, according to a recent IMF report, those still stand at $11 million every single minute, still going towards propping up the fossil fuel economy. So, you know, oil interests are hugely powerful, very well connected, and they're not going to give up their position easily. But I think people are starting to ask critical questions about the amount of state support they get through subsidies and tax breaks and other measures. They're asking questions also about who ultimately benefits. And we're seeing this in discussions, perhaps less in South Africa, but certainly in other parts of Africa, about who is going to capture the benefits of the new rush to oil, which is being talked about in parts of Kenya or Mozambique or new waves of investment in Nigeria, for example. And of course, people ask questions about, well, who's really benefited in the past? Because it's often not the poorer people that have to live with local environmental damage or often don't get the jobs that were promised. It's often richer government or corporate elites that benefit most from that. So there are big questions about the viability and, you know, the economic, social, environmental benefits that come from oil. So, you know, questions are being asked on all fronts. So yes, the oil economy is affected by the lowering costs of renewable energy, but also by these many other things.
Earlier, I asked you about the enabling conditions for a just energy transition. And I want to ask you perhaps a little bit deeper, how are we going to accelerate this energy transition to a just place? Are there any trade-offs that need to be made between people, profits, and planet?
Yes, there are lots of trade-offs. This is what makes it so hard. And of course, there's no like one model or one recipe for how to do this. And in terms of the scale and speed of action that's now required, we don't have many positive historical precedents. You know, that of course, there have been energy transitions in the past. Sometimes they evolve over decades or even a century or more. In other cases, when you're talking about the rollout of things like cook stoves or the diffusion of nuclear power, they can happen much more quickly. But just transitions really have to be quite context specific because there's always particular winners and losers in any one setting. And so it matters a lot whether you're talking about, you know, coal workers or whether you're talking about people involved in the nuclear sector or hydro or whichever sector and region it is. And of course, they bring different justice issues to the table. So for example, we've been doing some work recently on oil and gas transitions in Africa around these questions of justice. And in Nigeria, often the starting point is what they call restorative justice. You know, they want a conversation about why compensation hasn't been forthcoming so far for previous oil damage and lack of access to the revenues that have been generated before you can meaningfully talk about a future-facing discussion around just transition. So there's all these temporal and spatial trade-offs. And another thing that we're seeing, I think, globally is the way in which transitions pursued in one part of the world have a huge impact on resources elsewhere. So for example, the drive towards electrification in Europe and North America to some extent has a big impact on mineral mining for lithium and cobalt and minerals like that in places like the lithium triangle in Latin America between Bolivia, Argentina and Chile, or mining for cobalt in DRC in Africa. So choices made in one part of the world, often richer parts of the world, have knock-on impacts elsewhere. And that's another really difficult justice dimension to bring into this. How do we hold these actors to account through the supply chain or through regulation or litigation in some cases? We need to really think carefully about the range of tools that we need to deal with these sort of spatial and temporal, as well as, of course, the intergenerational aspects I talked about. And one of the key things for me is how do you square the necessary speed and urgency, which we obviously require, and that's become even clearer with the latest IPCC report, with the corresponding need for equity and inclusion, because there are some difficult choices there. In other words, bringing everyone along and having deep, deliberative, participatory processes, which everyone is involved with, takes time. And time is one thing we don't have. So I think we need to think about, you know, which areas of transition do we really need this opening up and deliberation and engagement around, and which things possibly could happen without that in order to make sure that we stick within, you know, 1.5 or 2 degree budgets.
So this perhaps is a cheeky question to ask, because I'm going to benefit greatly from this. So I wanted to know, which thought leaders are you currently reading and listening to at the moment that you consider important voices in the just energy transition? What are they saying that is compelling to you?
Yeah, I mean, there's a huge amount of scholarship now on just transitions, and a lot of it I find really useful. I mean, the work of people like Dimitris Stevis is very good, I think, in historicizing just transition debates, and he actually has a new book coming out on just transition, which tries to go back to the sort of longer history of where this idea came from and how it's evolved. And I think that's very useful, because people tend to think about it as something that's very, very new. We've only just thought about this. Whereas, of course, you know, different actors, and particularly trade unions, but others too, have been thinking about this and engaging with it for a very, very long time. So I think that type of work is good. I like the book on just transitions by the South African scholars, Mark Swilling and Eva Anarchy. I think that was a fantastic book, one of the first to really pull together some of the key dimensions of just transitions and, of course, apply it in a South African context. I thought that was really useful. And, of course, you know, this is how academia works. We will start to expand and look at these issues in urban environments. So Matthew Hoffman has been doing some work on just transitions in cities, which I think is useful. Or Raphael Heffron looking at this in relation to global institutions and how they're trying to engage with these questions of just transition. Another interesting dimension, I think, is sort of some of the subaltern or often excluded voices, particularly from Indigenous groups. So Julia Whitaker's book on Indigenous activism and resistance to the fossil fuel economy, I think that type of work is very useful. And again, a timely reminder that Indigenous groups have been environmental defenders in different ways for centuries, really. And for them, questions of justice, and again, not just justice in the ways we were talking about it earlier around procedural or distributional elements, but also justice to nature. Because, you know, for, of course, in many Indigenous worldviews, they don't recognize that distinction between the human and the environment. So I think those sorts of perspectives are useful in sort of bringing that more historical and an altogether different view that brings all these different elements together.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. And for your vulnerability and also for your really nuanced and balanced insights in general throughout this episode. But before I get to the last question, I want to just let the listeners know that if you'd like to follow more of Peter's work, you can follow him on Twitter at PeterJNewell_. And so for the last question, given your expertise, what question should I have asked you?
You could have asked me something about whether we can bring about transitions that are sustainable and just with the economy we currently have. Because my view is we need to move this debate onto some of the fundamentals of the economy and how to rewire the political economy in terms of work and income and production and consumption in a far more fundamental way than we currently are. I think at the moment we're talking about issues of compensation and retraining in just transition and sort of managing some of the negative spillovers and effects of trying to accelerate change. But we're not really getting into those deeper questions about the need to rewire the economy. And again, that's not just around energy and climate. That's around a whole range of different environmental problems that are generated by the way the global economy currently works, which is obviously bypassing planetary boundaries of all sorts. So yeah, that would be a good question to ask about how far we need some deeper rewiring of the economy if we're to get anything like a just transition.
Thank you for joining us today. If you enjoyed what you heard, please subscribe, rate, and leave a review. Next episode, I will be asking more creatives and intellectual disruptors about making decisions at the margin. See you next time.